On a Monday, you're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up after 7:30, we'll hear about an appeal from Wisconsin caregiving agencies, and they're asking the state's Joint Finance Committee to boost the Medicaid personal care rate to address a severe staffing shortage. But first, we're talking about this investigation at the UW-Oshkosh involving racist, homophobic, and anti-Semitic images on social media that involved students. The Oshkosh Northwestern reported that the images that circulated on Twitter last week showed a whiteboard with the message, "No liberals, Jews, Muslims, queers, or Hmongs." Another image showed a room with a banner that appeared to have a hand-painted swastika on it. Oshkosh residents and students, there's a line for you during this conversation, 800-642-1234. What do you want the chancellor to know as to how you're feeling about this? What would you suggest the university do moving forward? UW-Oshkosh Chancellor Andrew Levitt is here to tell us about the community meeting and the investigation into these images. Chancellor Levitt, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate.
So what do you know right now about this incident and what is being investigated?
Well, sometime last Thursday evening, there were images that were posted on social media that depicted what you had described previous to that. It was at a private residence within the city of Oshkosh where we had renters. The renters were UWO students that lived there, and then there were apparently some kind of a party that was going on at the time. Those images very quickly circulated, and then we as a university first detected the presence of those images shortly after midnight, where I was alerted and others were alerted. We worked with a few administrators in the middle of the night in order to sort of ramp up what we wanted to do the next day. We met at 8 o'clock in the morning. As a group, we had a statement out shortly after 9 o'clock to the entire campus about this, certainly condemning the images themselves. And then we arranged to have an open forum, which occurred at 1 p.m. To allow to give information to students, but also at the same time allow them an opportunity to use their voice. What we know at this point is that we are investigating all the aspects of this through our Dean of Students Office, which is the Student Code of Conduct process, as well as the UW-Oshkosh Police Department. We need to determine if, in fact, there were policies and or laws that were broken that would lead to some kind of sanction. So we are in the process of that investigation.
How long might this investigation take?
It's about interviewing witnesses and people who were there. And so normally we have a rather elaborate code of conduct process that you have to go through, which allows individuals to have hearings as a part of the investigation. So we believe it could take up to a few weeks.
You hosted this community forum then on Friday afternoon. What did you hear from those who spoke out?
Well, there are many things that we heard. One, of course, certainly a condemnation and a concern for the content of these images. No question about that. There were expressions, particularly among those from marginalized backgrounds, students of diversity, of their concern for their personal safety on campus. And this is not the first time these things happen. This has happened on this campus or quite frankly, any other university campus. It quite frankly, it's heartbreaking to hear stories from students of diversity, students of color, LGBTQ, of where they don't feel safe in an environment which they're supposed to learn. And so it's important to give them a voice. We certainly have heard them in the past. And, the students are certainly expressing a certain level of frustration of what they perceive to be inaction by the university. And so it was an opportunity for us to enumerate some of the things that we've done just recent weeks and months, in addition to what we hope to do in the future.
Hundreds of students turned out at this forum. What did you make of the crowd and what the sentiment was like?
Well, I thought it was terrific that so many students came and so quickly and really no notice. And that really, I think, is a very positive sign that the campus does vehemently reject the expressions of hate and bigotry. No question, it was a difficult hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes as students were able to get up and express their own frustrations, why this keeps happening, and what can we do about it.
We're talking with Andrew Levitt. He is chancellor of the UW Oshkosh, talking about social media posts that surfaced last week that show photos of racist and homophobic messages and hateful symbols that officials believe involve students. And there's a line for you on this conversation at 800-642-1234. Students and community members, did you attend the community forum Friday? What did you share about your experience at the university? And how is the work that you're doing at the university helping to build a climate of inclusivity? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Chancellor Levitt, this isn't the first time, as you alluded, that your university has dealt with images on social media. There was, in March, a Snapchat image that surfaced involving two men running for student body leadership positions. It also said, UWO, vote for these guys today unless you want a lesbian or a Hmong to win. Can you talk about how the university has reacted in recent months to this kind of discrimination?
Well, the one thing you need to realize is, first of all, we can't control what people put on social media. It's a platform with a very low bar for people to post hateful messages. There's no question about that. So in individuals, in this case, they were associated with the university, but sometimes they're not, can do something like this that really touches off this kind of event. The way that we have to fight this, quite frankly, is through communication, conversation, and education. And it's something that we feel very strongly about. We had started previously a training program for all students, must take training on workplace sexual violence in order to combat issues related to that. We have had for several years now, as a part of the student's orientation, a program about unconscious bias that we do. The biggest challenge that we face, quite frankly, is the fact that somewhere between 2,500 to 3,000 students turn over every year at this institution through graduation and through the incoming class and through people who transfer out or through attrition. So we are always working with a new group of students, seemingly every year, that quite frankly have come from all sorts of different backgrounds, where they may or may not have much experience with diversity, or they may or may not have much experience with what's appropriate discourse on social media or in public. And so it's a constant challenge of educating students as to what our values are as an institution and also what's appropriate.
Chancellor Andrew Levitt of UW Oshkosh stays with us as we continue our look at an investigation into racist and anti-Semitic images posted on social media involving students. And you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What should inclusion look like on our college campuses? What should campuses do about messages of bias and hate? And students, what do you need to do to feel safe? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. And this conversation continues in just a minute. Maybe hear from you on the Ideas Network. Several hundred students at UW Oshkosh attended a meeting Friday. It comes after racist images appeared on social media last week that may have involved students on campus. And we're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. taking your thoughts on the situation at UW Oshkosh. What is the role of the university when it comes to inclusion and safety? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Andrew Levitt is chancellor of the UW Oshkosh, and he stays with us. Let's go straight to the phones now with Cassandra joining us from Oshkosh. Hi, Cassandra.
Hi there.
What do you think?
Well, I was a student at UW Oshkosh, although I graduated back in 2004. So obviously things have changed somewhat with our social and political climate since then. And I feel like this kind of stuff is sort of a symptom of the broader message that we're getting on a national scale, that people feel a little more empowered to be public with their hatred. And those are the messages people are getting. So we're seeing a lot more of this kind of thing coming out. And at the same time, I also wonder, you know, even if someone feels that way, and no matter how wrongheaded it may be, how can we really tell people how they can, you know, decorate their homes with hateful imagery, you know?
Cassandra, yeah. Thank you so much for the call. Chancellor Levitt, what do you hear there?
Well, I would say we have seen an uptick in terms of unconscious and conscious bias in recent years for whatever reason. This is a difficult subject on college campuses. I know that, for instance, President Trump had recently signed an executive order stating that free speech is to be protected on college campuses. And so we have this balance that we have at all universities, where we're trying to provide an environment where students can be free of the attacks of personal identity, which really do create a hostile environment for them. But at the same time, it protects free speech of all students. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your position on the First Amendment, hate speech is protected speech. And it's so, for instance, as we investigate these incidences, we can only look for violations of policy and laws that involve other aspects of this case other than the actual content of the speech itself. So lots and lots of students want me to throw these individuals off campus, kick them out of school. We cannot do that because of the First Amendment. And we simply would just absolutely lose in court if, in fact, that were ever done. We're looking very carefully at the situation to see what other kinds of policies may have been broken.
Let's go to Dave now, joining us from Milwaukee. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. I'm just so outraged. And I just want to say that as an educator, we in the Milwaukee public school system, we're working diligently to protect our students from this terror. And that's what it is. It's terror. And the Constitution and the Bill of Rights has been held up long enough as this protection, just like you said, Chancellor, free speech. And it's nonsense. If you are a straight white male and you make a comment that's in any way derisive of any group, that is terror, period. And if you're not, if you're any other group and you say something, that's fine. I mean, that's the way it should be. So we need to come down hard. We need to throw out the First Amendment and hopefully second next. And we need to just punish these straight white males, no matter what they say or do. They have no, obviously in 50 years there won't be very many straight white males, so it won't be a big problem.
Dave, I want to jump in right there. Chancellor Levitt, we're aware that the internet connects us all across the world, and you know, you can share messages, you can share information, you can spread terror, as Dave mentioned. How do you think UW Oshkosh students are being affected by what they see online and on social media?
Well, I think they're being affected greatly. I think that's a more pervasive problem or issue. It's not just higher education. It's all walks of life, to be sure. Today's point, you know, there are lines that's possible to cross in free speech if it hinges on a harassment or a threat. And again, those are aspects of this that we're definitely evaluating to see if any of this was targeting a specific individual. certainly in the case that happened in March that you mentioned before about the Oshkosh Student Association elections, there were individuals that were associated with the groups that were mentioned because they were other candidates, and so that was as close as you would get to a personal targeting. So that was an issue certainly there. But yeah, this is a problem. You know, the social media on one idea, it democratizes knowledge, but at the same time, it also provides a platform for some pretty despicable behavior.
Let's go to Jay now, joining us from Milwaukee. Jay, hi.
Hi there.
What's
so,
up? Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say I share the last caller's outrage, absolutely, as I'm sure many listeners and callers do. And I think what a lot of folks might be wanting to hear is perhaps a little bit more of that outrage coming from the university. I mean, be it protected First Amendment or not, this is hate speech. I mean, plain and simple. And I think inherently that comes with harassment and a threatening tone. And I think it has absolutely no place on university campus. As a UW alum and instructor, I'm equally outraged. And I think we'd like to hear more of that from, quite frankly, from the chancellor and from the university.
Chancellor, are you considering longer-term strategies to help prevent this type of behavior? Are there changes that you can make today and in the future to help to be a more inclusive campus?
Kate, before I answer that, I do want to address what my initial comments were of this case in terms of expressing my outrage and indignation. In the message that I sent out to the campus community about 9 o'clock in the morning, so about an hour after the school day began, it opens with the line, "To anyone who brings hate into the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh community, I invite you to leave." And then later in that same message, it says, "I am angry and I am sorry for the pain these images cause. They are examples of hate and bias that defy everything we stand for as a university and inclusive community. We do not and will not tolerate it." So this is our position as a university. And so to suggest for a moment that somehow that we're tolerant of this type of behavior is quite frankly outrageous. We have to live within the bounds of following the law and following the policies of university. And first and foremost on my mind always is the personal safety of every single person on this campus. And so it's, to me, and I've gotten this before, that people think, well, geez, since you're not expelling these students, you must be condoning their behavior, and nothing could be further from the truth. So what are we doing? We have a number of initiatives in place, and we've had for some time. It really starts with increasing the diversity of the institution. I think that the more diverse we can be, the fewer problems in the end that we're going to end up having. And so we've been able to accomplish that in the following way. When I first came in as chancellor four to 5 years ago, our students of color were at 11% of the total population. This fall, they'll be at 17%. That's a pretty marked increase in the number of students of color on the campus. So now that when you walk across campus, you definitely notice diversity. Second, what we've put in a number of programs in place. We've started the Men of Color Initiative. We need to make sure that all students are more successful. Across the board, all of our student success measures, whether they be for white students or students of color, are on the rise, which we're making students more successful. Third, and this is really our Achilles heel, it comes with our faculty and staff of color. Right now, it's lagging pretty considerably behind students at about 6 to 7%. We have a program that we're putting in place to attract, retain, and hire more faculty of color, and this is being initiated, spearheaded by our provost, who's new to that position. It's important that we hire people of color up and down the organization, not simply at the entry-level positions, but also at senior management and at middle management, and we have done that. We are moving a needle. Can we do better? Absolutely. But there are a number of things that we are putting in place in order to make sure that we can build a more inclusive environment. We will never be able to protect every student from this type of hate speech simply because we cannot control human beings. But it's how we respond to it as a community that's going to matter.
In the hour since this has occurred, have you thought about how you have changed and your approach as a university to hate speech?
This is something that's happened before, that really hasn't happened at this level of intensity before. And so we know that there are lots of students out there who are hurting, and particularly students of color. And I think what we can do to be better is to learn from this event in terms of the avenues and how we can better support students, unfortunately, after one of these events might happen. So that's something that we're working on in terms of after action reports. Of course, really right in the middle of this right now. So we are working very hard to manage this for the next 2 weeks as students finish their classes and enter final exams.
Chancellor, we have to end it here. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Chancellor Andrew Leavitt is Chancellor of the UW-Oshkosh, talking about the response to social media posts that show photos of racist and homophobic messages, hateful symbols that Oshkosh officials believe involve students. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Personal Services Association has come out with the results of a survey, and it found that every personal care agency that took the survey said they had to turn away older adults and people with disabilities at some point in need of care due to a worker shortage. Do you work for a caregiving agency? And if so, have you seen the impact of staffing shortages? Are you someone who relies on care? If so, what challenges have you faced in getting the care you need? Have you been turned away? Join in at 800-642-1234. Erin Fabrizius is spokesperson for the Wisconsin Personal Services Association, and that's the state's primary professional organization for personal care and other community-based home care providers. Erin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So set the stage for us. How would you describe the current state of caregiving in Wisconsin?
So we are currently, as a state, experiencing a personal care workforce shortage so severe that it is jeopardizing the health, safety, and independence of our older adults and people with disabilities, and also the survival of our personal care agencies that are providing this care.
Has this been a downward trend? Have you seen this staffing shortage increase in recent years, in recent decades?
Yeah, so we really have seen a shift over the last few years. We are now at the point where we have personal care agencies that have turnover rates of more than 50%. You also saw in our survey that we just recently released survey data where 100% of personal care agencies have had to turn away people in need of care because they don't have enough personal care workers. And really what this means is that today in Wisconsin, someone woke up after having spent the night in their wheelchair because they didn't have a personal care worker to get them out of bed this morning. Someone is going to miss work because there's not a worker to help them get dressed. Someone who needs help going to the bathroom is not going to have that assistance. These are basic needs that personal care workers provide. Truly, these activities that are essential for daily living. And our older adults and people with disabilities and our agencies are telling us that as a state, we are at a crisis level shortage of personal care workers.
So when an agency turns someone away or puts them on a waiting list, mm-hmm. what does that person do, that client who is turned away?
Yeah, so it's terrifying, really. So we have people who are family caregivers who are either missing work or quitting their jobs because if not, their loved ones are possibly unattended at home. And you also see in our survey, we have some really startling data. So agencies have told us that over the past year, 70% of agencies have had clients that have had to relocate from their home to a more restrictive setting. So personal care workers, they really are these kind of frontline home care workers that are providing these in-home supports. And 70% of agencies are saying that they are seeing people no longer being able to continue living in their own homes, half of agencies have had consumers who have been unnecessarily hospitalized. 63% of agencies have noticed clients suffering a change in condition. So this means they got less independent. Their health got worse. And this is all happening because we really do not have these frontline personal care workers.
We're talking with Aaron Fabrizius, who is a spokesperson for the Wisconsin Personal Services Association, looking at survey results from a recent study that polled agencies as to how they are getting along in this shortage of workers. You can join in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Rana joining us from Cameron. Hi, Rana.
Hi, good morning. Fabulous topic. We're living with it right now. Just a little bio. I retired early as a teacher to care for my dad and my mom. My dad lives in our home. We did not have any intentions of ever placing him in some type of a facility because there just are not enough care people in the care facilities to give excellent one-on-one or even one-on-five attention. But my bigger point this morning is making sure that people have a POA and a POM appointed. As my dad and I move through this journey, we are seeing some very, very unnecessarily sad situations occurring because no one has been appointed to care for a particular person, and they've kind of just been left to, I don't want to say the wolves, but they've been left to figure it out for themselves, and it's just not working right. So POA, POM, super important.
Rana is saying power of attorney there and making sure that's okay. Thank you, Rana. Aaron, go ahead.
Yeah, well, Rana, thank you so much for your contributions, and your story, unfortunately, is not uncommon. We've had so many family caregivers telling us that they have had to quit work early or retire early because there are not enough personal care workers. So we have family members who are stepping up because there is literally no one there to provide this care. And again, on our survey, we had 70% of personal care agencies told us that they have a large amount of clients who can't even get all the care that they have been authorized for due to the lack of workers. So we have just one agency in northern Wisconsin said that she has 20-plus hours of care per day that she cannot find a personal care worker to staff. That's 600 hours per month. And that is one agency in northern Wisconsin. And again, on this survey, every single agency that responded told us that they are doing the same thing. They are turning people away.
In response to this issue, some residents have made an appeal to the legislature's Joint Finance Committee to increase the Medicaid personal care rate by at least 11%. Before we get into the why, can you explain what the personal care rate is and where it stands right now?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The current personal care rate, so that's a Medicaid reimbursement rate that's paid to our personal care agencies who are providing care and to run their business, is currently $16.73 per hour. So as you can imagine, with this underfunding over decades and this low rate, it's really prevented wages from increasing. So we now have agencies that any agency you talk to will tell you they cannot compete with Quick Trip or McDonald's.
Because they're paying the caregiver around 10 something.
Yeah, so
hour?
I think average personal care worker pay is about a $10 or $11 per hour. And again, we have gone years and years without an increase to this rate, and so it's been impossible to raise wages. And again, any agency will tell you Quick Trip can do starting pay at $13 or $15 an hour. We just can't compete, and these are important, intimate home care jobs.
Former Governor Scott Walker's final budget increased Medicaid spending by $183 million. Did that help the situation at all in home care?
Yeah, so Governor Walker, in his final budget as governor, acknowledged the very seriousness of this personal care crisis. And actually, he had the largest increase to personal care in 14 years. Prior to the increase in his budget, which was about 2% per year, the personal care rate had only increased by 24 cents over 14 years. So again, there has been serious chronic underfunding.
Let's go to Karen now in Green Bay. Karen, hi.
Hi. I'm calling, and I guess my question was answered. I was wondering if it was a pay situation, because where I work, we have a lot of moms who are CNAs and they're single moms, and they cannot possibly live on what is being paid to them. And what angers me, and okay, I just heard what the reimbursement rate is, but I see some of these home care businesses, and their owners have, you know, two houses, or, you know, close to yachts as far as boats and things like that. And so I feel they're taking advantage of their workers.
Karen, thanks for the call. And so some of that reimbursement rate is going to the overhead of paying for the health insurance and the staffing and the scheduling and the billing. Mm-hmm. And that is considerable overhead.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, agencies are really struggling to keep their doors open. But Karen actually raised a really important point that I want to respond to, which is we have a continuum of caregiving. So that could include what she mentioned were certified nursing assistants, CNAs, or registered nurses. And what we're talking about are our personal care workers. So that is, again, in-home care. The overhead is lower. So this is a different type of job than what a certified nursing assistant would be doing.
So who, if you do increase the reimbursement rate by 11%, how does that translate into dollars? How many millions of dollars would it cost to cover that type of rate hike?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. So Governor Evers also acknowledges in his budget the seriousness of his crisis. And he includes by the end of the biennium, it would be a 3% increase to the Medicaid personal care rate. So to get to that 11%, to fund that additional 8% would be about $14.5 million in state taxpayer dollars. But what's important about that is any investment our state makes in Medicaid is matched by the federal government. That's about a 60% match. So by investing $14.5 million approximately in state funds, we would draw down a lot more federal dollars.
So where do you think the reimbursement rate needs to be at? You're at 1670 something right now. And where can it be to be sustainable?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you're right. We are asking for an 11% increase really to prevent what we see as the collapse of this network. On our survey, we had more than half of agencies telling us that they are thinking about no longer providing Medicaid personal care services because this rate is so low. And what agencies are telling us is that the cost of care is about $2 more than the current rate. So that 11% we're asking for would get us to about that $2 to really kind of break even here. And so one thing that, in addition to the 11% increase ask that we have, we are very excited because Governor Evers announced that he is going to be creating a task force on caregiving. And we see that as a great opportunity to really have some thoughtful discussions with the legislature and the administration about how we can come up with a comprehensive set of solutions here.
We're talking with Erin Fabrizius with the Wisconsin Personal Services Association. You can join in 800-642-1234. Do you think it's necessary to boost the Medicaid personal care rate, which helps fund things like in-home care? What effect would it have? What questions do you have about the state of caregiving in Wisconsin? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the State Capitol Report in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report. We're talking about an effort to increase the Medicaid reimbursement rate for personal care, and it could help ease a shortage of workers. Some residents are now appealing to the state's Joint Finance Committee to boost the Medicaid personal care rate, which helps fund in-home care. You can join in with your situation, your insights, 800-642-1234. Are you someone who relies on in-home care? And if so, what challenges have you faced in getting the care you need? Have you been turned away? Do you think the Medicaid reimbursement should be increased? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Erin Fabrizius is a spokesperson for the Wisconsin Personal Services Association. Let's go back to the phones now with Mike joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. I just want to say my girlfriend was a caregiver. She left the industry in January to work for a company that had benefits in another hospital-related industry. And the pay is just so low, you can't live on it. And that's basically my comment. And trying to increase your skills, it almost doesn't pay in that industry. The pay is just so low. Even if you do have a CNA certification, it's still low. And you might be lifting someone that weighs 300 pounds. You know, it's hard work.
Mike, thank you for the call. And his girlfriend left for a job with benefits.
Yeah, that is not uncommon. As I said before, agencies are having trouble competing with companies like Quick Trip and McDonald's. And you're seeing data from the Paraprofessional Health Institute, which is kind of a national research group that looks at home care issues in all 50 states, that in Wisconsin, about 40% of our personal care workers are on some type of public assistance because those wages are so low. And again, with this low reimbursement rate that has been underfunded for decades, agencies are not able to provide those benefits. And again, you know, as Mike is saying, this is such important work. Personal care workers are really the glue that holds our long-term care system together, and they are doing very intimate cares. This is about getting people out of bed in the morning, helping people go to the bathroom, to get dressed, to bathe. This is intimate support, and we really need to value this work.
It's also physical work as well.
That's correct.
Let's go to Esty now in Madison. Esty, hi.
Hi. So my father lives in Israel. He's 92 years old. He has Alzheimer's. He lives in the home where I grew up, and he lives with a live-in person who is with him 24/7. He came from Sri Lanka, and there are people like that all over Israel who live at home with people, keep them, you know, do all the intimate work that you keep mentioning, and keep the house clean, cook for them. It's absolutely amazing for them. I talked with several of them, and for them, it's what they make is high salaries. It's a salary that Israelis wouldn't want, but they actually end up building homes in their countries when they are done. And it occurs to me that here in this country, we have, you know, thousands of people in basically in concentration camps on the border who I'm sure would be very glad to do that, you know, get that salary that is higher than in their countries of origin and have board and you know, they sleep there
really
and
bored.
They eat meals there. So...
Esty, I'm gonna jump in right here. Around the clock care is a whole different area as well, which can be extraordinarily costly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and with personal care, we really are looking at, you know, there are people who do have those 24/7 needs, but there are also people who have a need for just a couple of hours a day of care. And again, that's really just to help people go to work and to be independent and healthy and live in their own homes. As Esty is saying, people want to be in their own homes, and personal care workers are the people who do that work to make it possible.
Let's go to Lori in Tomahawk. Lori, hi.
Yes, my dad is 97. He's in a facility in Rhinelander. He's not on Medicaid. He's a private pay person. And we've had to hire 24-hour private pay help in addition to the nursing home because they cannot handle him. Their nighttime population can be up to 95 in this facility, and they have five nurses' aides on to handle that. And the state has deemed that that's enough people. So they don't have the training. They don't have the salaries that support them in this career, and so they leave and go elsewhere. We're paying $23 an hour for private duty help, and we're paying about $9,500 for the facility.
Lori, thank you for the call. This is an enormous strain on families, the amount of money in terms of private private pay.
Absolutely. And yeah, in a facility, you would see even higher cost. Again, personal care workers, they're not working in facilities. They're working in people's homes, in their own homes. But certainly, we see this across our continuum of care in Wisconsin. People, our long-term care system was built on the concept of choice, and people do have the right to choose what setting they receive their care in. And we are seeing shortages across that continuum of care.
Let's go to Ann in Madison with thoughts. Ann, hi.
Hi. I work for a management company here in Madison that provides services to people living in their homes. And there are two things that I wanted to mention. One, so many people are being hired from other countries who are not able to read or speak the language well enough to learn the things that are being taught in the classes before they're put into the home. This is, you know, they're dealing with people with seizures and brain injuries and, you know, heavy medical issues, and they come into the home and they didn't understand their training, so they're not ready when they get here. The other thing is that the management company does not treat their employees with respect. They just don't, because they are one, it's like a herd, you know, a herd going through, and, you know, we have such changeover, such constant change in staffing that they don't establish relationships with their employees and make them feel valued and give them the things they need to do the job well and be successful.
Ann, thanks for the call. Erin, I want you to jump in here.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think our personal care agencies absolutely value their workers, but you're right, we are struggling with very high turnover rates. Agencies have between a 50% and 60% yearly turnover rate. Again, these wages are very low. It's very difficult to compete with other companies to recruit and retain workers. But you also hit on an important point, which is, again, a reason why we are excited about Governor Evers' Task Force on Caregiving. Is we need to look beyond the rate to more comprehensive solutions as well. So that includes quality training. WPSA, we've actually developed what we believe is a model for personal care training called Direct Care Competencies. And this helps make sure that our caregivers are ready on day one to go into people's homes and provide this support. And we also need to be talking about caregiving as a career, to really promote this work as part of the healthcare career ladder. So there are all sorts of things we can be looking at to really turn this into a great profession for people.
Erin, where are you at in the legislative process on this issue?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So the Joint Finance Committee, which is our legislature's budget writing committee, they just wrapped up kind of the first phase of the budget process in Wisconsin. They held their last public hearing on the budget in Green Bay last week. And soon they're going to be starting to vote on different portions of the budget. So we did, I thought, a great job of turning out people to talk about this personal care crisis at these hearings. We actually had Joint Finance Committee co-chair Alberta Darling say before that final hearing that personal care is something they really want to look at. And we are so grateful for those comments. So now we are ready to start really talking to lawmakers about what types of proposals we could put forward as that committee begins to vote on the budget.
Erin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Erin Fabrizius is a spokesperson for the Wisconsin Personal Services Association. That's a state's professional organization for personal care and other community-based home care providers. Just ahead, we're talking about technology for headlights that could make driving at night safer and why it's part of U.S. standards. It isn't part of U.S. standards right now. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.